Get organized and save big money with Dakota Closets at Menards. Dakota Closets can be installed in any room, from home offices and laundry rooms to walk-in or reach-in closets. Use the You Create Closet Planner, available in-store or online, to design a Dakota closet system that maximizes your space and matches your style. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. On October 11th, 1999, a film crew began principal photography in New Zealand on a trilogy of films that would go on to be some of the greatest films ever made, The Lord of the Rings. J.R.R. Tolkien's beloved books are a timeless masterpiece that have inspired generations of readers, and today these stories are more needed than ever as we are witnessing the fall of the West. As we see men without backbones and women ruling households, churches, and governments, we need to be re-enchanted with the stories from Middle-earth. Therefore, we are beginning our trek through Middle-earth, where we are going to review and discuss the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Along the way, we will ask any questions that need to be asked, and some of our answers may surprise you. Join us as we discuss the first film in the trilogy, The Fellowship of the Ring.
And we Christian Americans are the last hope for the West. Storytelling matters in this world.
There's a hunger for good stories.
We're tired of seeing Hollywood filth and slop.
That's what our goals are to make movies that are good, true, and beautiful, and glorify the Lord.
If we lose, if America loses, that's it for the West. Welcome, everyone. We are here. This is a Fearless Wandering podcast. This is our first official movie review under Fearless Wandering podcast, our production company, and we're excited to jump into this. We have a whole list of movies and ideas that we have for this, and we're starting off with a banger, of course, and we're really looking forward to seeing where this goes, and we hope that this episode stays at a reasonable length, but we'll have a lot to discuss, a lot to say. I'm one of your hosts, Trent Powell, joined by my other host, Tobiah Powell.
Yep.
How are you doing, Tobiah?
Doing good. I'm excited to do a review on this movie. You guys can expect a movie review at least once a month. Probably just once a month.
Yeah, this is just our time where we sit down and we, having watched the given movie for that week, we discuss it. We tear it apart, break it apart, bring out the good, the bad, the ugly, give our thoughts, tell stories about our experiences watching the film in the past, or maybe it was the first time we watched the movie, whatever it may be. We are just diving, really getting into the nitty gritty, but having fun doing it as well. We have just many different elements that we're looking for in films, and we really want to dissect them and bring them out and just give people a good idea of give people a paradigm of how they should look at films, how they should view films and stories, and what they should look for in movies, and what they should not be looking, or what they should be looking against, what we shouldn't be consuming, and so forth, and so. As we said in our cold open, we are tackling the Lord of the Rings trilogy. We're not going into The Hobbit. Maybe The Hobbit's for another day. I have many opinions about The Hobbit, more than I have about the Lord of the Rings films, and more negative than positive. So we'll cross that bridge if we ever come to it. But right now we're tackling the Lord of the Rings film trilogy.
Yeah. Yep. Starting with Fellowship.
Yep.
It kicks off the three act parts of Lord of the Rings, and
so Tobiah, Fellowship of the Ring, what are your initial thoughts going back to it, watching it again? Also, we should probably, I don't know if we need to give this disclaimer, but we watched the extended edition, because that's in my opinion, that's probably the best. I mean, that is the best way to watch it. I think everyone agrees with that. It's not just my opinion, but
definitely.
I don't even know if I've ever seen the theatrical version. Maybe the first time I saw it when I was like a kid, possibly, but for the most part, I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, I think I've pretty much always watched the extended. First thoughts, I love these movies. I mean, this first movie sets up a lot of things, a lot of setup in the first half of the movie, I would say. And yeah, I mean, these, I think it was very entertaining, and it kept my attention the whole time, and I didn't really think there was entirely any dull moments. Yeah, I mean, there's a fair bit of setup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I would very much agree. I love these films as well. In my more, as a kid, it was an escapism for me just to escape to another world, just to Middle Earth, and see it visualized on film. I saw the movies before I read the books, which is something, a mistake I will not make for my kids. They will be watching or reading the books before watching the movies. But because it really does color how you view the books in a lot of ways. If you just know the movies and you go to the books, and not necessarily, you know, you can sift through some things and disconnect. But in my older life, adult life, I've definitely become more of a fan of the books than the movies. I try to read the books every year, and I've just continued to just fall more in love with Tolkien's literature and his whole vast literature, the whole story of Middle Earth, you know, the Silmarillion and you know, all the other writings that he did within this world. Just continue to be fascinated by it, and will probably continue to be fascinated by it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But so going back to the movies, because I think there was a long period of time where I didn't watch the films, and going back to it this time was the first time in a while, and so I definitely have different opinions about the movies than I did maybe a handful of years ago. But as movies, man, these are incredible. I don't think they will ever see a trilogy reach this caliber. You know, I mean, Lord willing, you know, we're post-mill, you know, we're Christian nationalists, you know, we hope that maybe that won't be the case. Maybe we will see something as grand and on the scale of Peter Jackson's Middle Earth films. But yeah, initial thoughts, just going in, enjoyed it so much, just going back to Middle Earth on film, and just I did enjoy the Fellowship more than I have probably ever because I think growing up, you know, as a kid, as a teenager, it was always the battles. You know, I love Two Towers. I love the Rohirrim. I love the last battle in the Two Towers, and then going into Return of the King and all the fights and whatnot. Like the big scale, men fighting orcs and slaying the enemy, like that was all what I was about, and the weapons were always fascinating to me and whatnot. But like now going back, like that still fascinates me, but I think appreciating the hobbits and the Shire and the depiction of the hobbits and then following their journey out of the Shire and going on this grand adventure, and it was just I had a newfound appreciation for it, I think, that I hadn't had before. Just as I've gotten older, so that's just,
you kind of realize what they're giving up, and especially when it's right in the face of them, like they're living these comfortable lives in a comfortable place, but they know the threat that's coming, and they know that they could lose that, and so they realize what they have to do, what they're called to do, but there's definitely a great, I don't know, risk that they're taking.
For sure. Absolutely. So as we kind of set the stage for the plot, just the beginning of the film, we have this epic battle between good and evil. Just really setting the stage, like, this is what this story's about. It's good versus evil. You know who the bad guys are. You know who the good guys are. And even on the, you know, when you have good guys, like, you know, there's those that fail. You know, you have Isildur, you know, not throwing the ring into the fires of Mount Doom. You have human flaws, but you know, you have a clear picture of what's good, what's evil. You have this ring that's showing, it's setting the stage and the stakes for the film. Like, this is, it's about power. It's about this ring that that man is lusting after, that man wants in order to rule over others and so forth. And so you have that struggle, and it's clearly set up when you have when you have Isildur, you know, deciding not to throw the ring away after killing Sauron, the physical manifestation of Sauron there in Mordor, and you have that whole fight and stuff. So like it's really a good way to set up the film. And then you transition. What do you transition to? The Hobbits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Shire. It sets a new stage. It's like, oh, this is also this grand, exquisite battle. This massive battle between good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Hobbits in their peaceful Shire. You have the music playing concerning mm-hmm. Hobbits. Just really showing like, okay, the battle now reaches here. The story comes to here. This is where we begin.
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting. And, it shows that these people are cut off from the wars of the world, between men and orcs, between Sauron and the elves and men and all these conflicts happening. You have the Hobbits who are they're free from the evil that looms beyond the borders of the Shire. But then as the story progresses, we find out that, they are in danger, and that's why they go on this journey and mm-hmm. so forth. And
yeah,
but they're one of the last people that are untouched by the horrors of the world.
Yeah.
That's where the stage is set for us, mm-hmm. what we see at the beginning of this film. So
yeah.
I don't know, any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, they're the last stand of just of true peace and tranquility. And I think it's interesting when the ring gets into Hobbiton and seeing, I mean, it had been there with Bilbo, but the looming presence of it was essentially unknown, and seeing it become known and the dangers that are tied to that, and seeing how that's starting to seep into Hobbiton and it's calling the dangers.
Yeah. So, this is a high fantasy movie. It's action, it's adventure. Mm-hmm. It's all these things. And I think great setup for the story. Now as we look at this, we're looking at this film, one thing we're also asking is like, okay, what's happening behind the scenes? Okay. Like you have J.R.R. Tolkien's masterpiece in The Lord of the Rings. And The Hobbit coming before that. You have The Hobbit, you have The Lord of the Rings, you have all these other writings and this grand story that Tolkien gave 30 years of his life to.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing it on film, mm-hmm. 30 years or so after his death. Tolkien died in 1973. They began Prince of Photography in 1999. So, less than 30 years after his death, they're making this movie. Now, there's a lot of things that did happen behind the scenes. Peter Jackson and Warner Bros. The film was released December 19th, 2001. But going back, J.R.R. Tolkien, while he was still alive, and I didn't know this until today, actually, J.R.R. Tolkien sold the film, stage, and merchandising rights to The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit in the late 1960s, early 70s. He made it so that it was like towards the end of his life. He knew he was dying, and so in retirement, he sold the rights so that others can make these stories uh-huh. in plays. Sell merchandise and make films.
Yeah.
And what do we see happen after that? Just a handful of years actually after his death, is they make some animated films.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about those?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've watched through them once. They're kind of creepy. I mean,
yeah,
it's definitely not the a good depiction of the world that Tolkien made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I agree and disagree. I mean, like, these movies were made in the 70s, and mm-hmm. as far as looking at other animated films, it's pretty accurate. You look at like a lot of Disney films. I'm thinking, like, I know one that I actually recently saw was like Sword in the Stone. Like, it's got some weird stuff in it. Mm. And Alice in Wonderland. I don't even know what other movies came out in the 70s, but yeah. I feel like that was like kind of fit the animation style. But you're right. Like
the animation
like,
style,
the orcs and Smeagol are like we know what Smeagol look. We have our idea of what Smeagol looks like because of Andy Serkis and what they do with the movies. But, you know, they had the animators had a different choice, of course, way back then to as far as Smeagol. He looks like basically a frog and, you know, it was like a weird looking thing. But and then the orcs had like a unique look to them as well. And yeah, there's just a lot of weird, interesting imagery. So you have the they made the Hobbit animated film in that was in, I think, 1977. And then 1978, they made the Lord of the Rings. And then 1979, they did the Return of the King. So I'm pretty sure the Lord of the Rings is
the first
Fellowship
two,
and, and Two Towers.
Yeah.
And then the Return of the King. So they made three films, animated films. And yeah, they're, I don't know, I like old stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, which is, you know, some, you know, see our published works, see the things we've done in the past. Like we have these kind of disagreements and different views and perspectives on things, which is great.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of,
I'm,
you know, I have that like millennial perspective on some things, and Dubai has more of a Gen Z, and we're kind of a mix of the two, and it's really interesting. But anyways, I enjoy them, but I get why people don't like them. Like, I showed some of it to my kids, and they're like, "Yeah, this is weird. This is kind of scary. It's creepy, you know." And but so, anyways, they made the animated films a little bit after Tolkien passed away. And like I said, he had given the rights away. So, United Artists acquired the rights and sold them to Saul Zane's company in 1976. And so this United Artists company, they obtained the rights from Tolkien, and then they sold it to the Saul Zane's company. I'm probably mispronouncing that, in 1976. And they formed the Middle Earth Enterprises, MEE. And that's where the films where the animated films were produced. And then Peter Jackson and New Line Cinema, which is a Warner Brothers subsidiary, they licensed the rights from the Middle Earth Enterprises to make the Lord of the Rings films. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they continue to have those rights. They made the Hobbits and the Hobbit movies. Mm-hmm. And they're making another movie, which I'm sure we'll get into that a handful, a few times, as we have our thoughts on that. But The Hunt for Gollum, probably coming out next year or 2 years. I don't know when it's coming out.
Yeah, but I think next year, maybe.
Possibly. And then we won't even talk about Amazon.
Yeah.
Amazon received some rights to the appendix of Return of the King and so forth. And they've made their whole Second Age of Middle Earth show, which is absolutely awful.
Yeah.
So.
And there's War of the Rohirrim.
Right. Oh yeah. And there's that one. That was Warner Bros.
Yeah.
And I keep forgetting that movie exists. Yeah. I never saw it. I heard how terrible it was. I had so many problems with it. Didn't want to watch it. Still have no desire to watch it. It's just, it's Lord of the Rings fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't really want anything to do with that. So one question we have then going into this is, should these movies have been made? Okay, you have the animated films. They have their own stylistic choice. Tolkien did sell the rights to them. Should they have been made? My opinion of that is yes and no. Like, I think yes, because I think there's a lot of... these are great stories to be told to another generation. So many people were introduced to the Lord of the Rings because of the movies.
Yeah.
And then because they were introduced in the movies, they went to the books.
Mm-hmm.
Like us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It definitely... these movies definitely, I would say, kept Lord of the Rings alive, which I think a lot of people would be mad at me for saying that, but I think it kept that next generation who grew up with movies and reading a lot less than prior generations. It kept them entertained and kept Lord of the Rings alive, and I mean, it pushed a lot of people to the books. A lot of people that probably possibly would have never watched, read them had they not watched the movies.
100%. Yeah. So like, I like, for that reason, I would say yes, like it was good that they were made. And I'm happy with that. And, you know, but then there's the negative side for me where it's like, I think they took way too many liberties. Peter Jackson did. There's a lot of things they did right. I think capturing the atmosphere of the world, and, you know, from the score to the cinematography to doing it in New Zealand and all the set locations, all those things, I think were great. However, it's like, it's still Peter Jackson's vision of Middle Earth, trying to capture Tolkien's, you know, and so it's a blend of the two. So like the question always I have in my head is this what Tolkien envisioned when, you know, Peter Jackson created Hobbiton, created the Shire? Like, I don't know. Like I it's hard for me to really dissect that and think through. It's like, I have this vision of what it is because of the movies,
right?
You know, but I also want to, you know, capture that in the books. And I think there is a good blend of, you know, a good.
Well, there's lots of illustrations from Tolkien that we can look at to have an idea of what he envisioned. And they seem to be fairly similar, from what I've seen. Well, I mean, there's even times where you like, I mean, when you think of like when you first see, Rivendell and, I mean that, I think that is, a pretty good depiction of what, Tolkien had drawn up.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and like I can be always be nitpicky, and I will be nitpicky at times on this, because like, you know, even like I think even Peter Jackson's depiction of the elves, my problem with them is that they're too human like because in the books they're like almost otherworldly, like they're like I'd say like a blend of like human and angelic beings, like they're kind of in that middle, and I don't think they depicted it well though. Like whenever, like, you know, when we see Galadriel at first, like they tried to capture that where she like she's glowing and you know, like she's like you know, like a star incarnate, you know, and like they kind of depict that well, but then once she comes as a character into the story, she's just, you know, a human with elf ears and, you know, a beautiful dress. And like, so for that, like, I don't know how else I would have done it. And it's probably it makes sense cinematically for them to do this. Like, I think a lot of my issues are like more along the lines of, I just don't think this goes well in film. And so it makes sense that they made the choice that they did. Like, we can get into Tom Bombadil, whether or not he should have been in the film. I love Tom Bombadil, but does he fit in the movie? I go back and forth on that. Like, he serves a purpose in the books. But a lot of people would argue that it's like it doesn't actually help the characters progress and so forth. And it's like, well, okay, I kind of understand that as far as we're telling this story, and as, you know, the hobbits are trying to get to find Gandalf, and as they're trying to you know, be free of the Nazgul and the Black Riders and so forth. So it's like, yeah, I get it why Peter Jackson didn't include him. There's already so much to include in the film. But I always wonder, like, could we have had one little, like, a few scenes with Tom Bombadil and, you know, would that even work? I don't know. Probably not. And probably they probably wouldn't have been able to depict him that well, because he's such this strange, unique character. So anyways, not to be nitpicky, we need to keep going. So we move into following just the story, you know, the architecture of this story. You know, we have the protagonist, Frodo, who is, you know, he's the nephew of Bilbo, who we know of from The Hobbit, and he's Bilbo's gone on adventures, and you have, you know, at the beginning Bilbo's writing his story, and he's going to eventually give it to Frodo, and Frodo is this innocent character who's, you know, an unlikely hero who is being brought into this greater world. He's friends with Gandalf. Gandalf comes and visits him, and they have, you know, shows that there's some friendship there, and so forth. But I don't know. What do you think about Frodo and kind of how the story begins with him and sets him up going forward?
I mean, I think he's trying to think of. He's not, you wouldn't expect him to want to go on this big adventure. You wouldn't expect him to really want to leave Hobbiton. You know, he's got his friends there. He enjoys going out to drink with them. But at the same time, you kind of feel like there's something off about him. He's there's almost like a uncertainty about himself, and he's not sure really. Like he enjoys being there, but he also at the same time doesn't seem like he knows how he fits in, and he almost you feel like there's like this lack of purpose and meaning behind himself.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like there's a level of dissatisfaction in him and
discontentment almost.
Yeah.
In just his life.
Yeah. Cause he you see all the other characters around him and they're all extremely, joyful and cheerful. And then they all love to drink and, you know, he likes to go along with them, but there's just this, discontentment or somberness around Frodo that makes him just stick out a little bit and makes you question him and his purposes and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he knows there's mystery around his uncle Bilbo. Like he mm-hmm. knows he's gone on all these adventures, but there's something strange about him. You know, Bilbo, he's 111. Is that right? I think he's having his 111th birthday, or how do they say it? I don't know, however they
11th
say it. 111th birthday or something like that. He has his birthday, and yet he looks like he's in his 70s or, you know, mm-hmm. in the Hobbit years. Like he looks young, and so there's this mystery around him. Mm-hmm. Frodo also knows, I think some of that strangeness is him, is uncertainty about Bilbo mm-hmm. and what's going on with him. And then Bilbo is going to give him his inheritance. Like Frodo has an inheritance in Hobbiton
mm-hmm.
and Frodo would expect to receive that inheritance and so forth and continue on and as just a typical hobbit in mm-hmm. in this world and in the world that he's grown up in and yet he's pulled into this grand story. This is where we meet Gandalf. Now what purpose does Gandalf's character play in this story?
Well, when we first see him, he's like, he's Frodo's friend. And it's funny to see this big gray wizard coming into Hobbiton with all these little people. And he seems to be very fond of them.
Little people, that's not very politically correct. What are we allowed to call them?
Yeah.
There's also a lot of dwarves in this film.
Yeah.
Peter Dinklage would have a thing to say about that.
And they didn't even use real dwarves.
Right.
But yeah. Anyway, where's that going? He's very fond of Frodo and seems to there's just like kind of a mystery of like, oh, you have this wizard that is coming into Hobbiton. It's the first wizard we've seen in the movie, and you got all these great other creatures of, you know, he got Sauron and the orcs, and you see Gandalf as like the first wizard, and he's a friend of them. You can kind of guess like he's probably just keeping an eye on him too because he cares about him. He seems to know a bit about Bilbo and his past and has a connection there, which we know of from The Hobbit, that he was very involved with Bilbo's journey, and you learn that right away that people know about that, and they some of the hobbits despise him for taking him out on adventure and giving him all these grand ideas and thoughts and so you have him coming in and you can see he's kind of like a mentor or a guide for them. And as you kind of go on, you kind of see that more and more that he really is a guide and he knows about the ring and the dangers it poses. And he goes on to discover it and wants to learn more about it and see if it really is the One Ring. And yeah.
Right. Yeah. He goes off and he's not certain about all these things. Like, he's heard about, you know, ancient rings and their purposes in Middle Earth, and now he's, you know, there's this one ring and he needs to learn more about it. And so he goes to the halls of Minas Tirith and Gondor and searches out. And what's funny is in the book that period of time is like, what, I think 30 years or so. Something that yeah. Gandalf runs off and learns about the ring. Wow. And which of course shows that, you know, Frodo's also stuck. No, it's not stuck. He's there in the Shire for that whole time.
Yeah.
And, you know, not really, you know, not set on going on any adventures, but, you know, knows he has this ring and there's some mystery around it. And he's trying to figure things out as far as his future and whatnot. And
yeah.
And now it's like Gandalf's gone and he's waiting for him to return. And then he, of course, does suddenly. And, you know, it's a briefer period in the movie, which, of course, makes sense, you know, cinematically. But he comes back and he's like, "Hey, Frodo, here's the deal. This is what this ring is about, and you have a task ahead of you."
Yeah,
you know, you have the call to action for Frodo, and he has to make that decision of whether or not he's going to go on this adventure. The ring needs to be taken.
Needs to be taken to Rivendell.
Needs taken to Rivendell. That's the goal. Take it to the elves. Take it to Elrond, so that they can decide what to do with this grand object, this grand ring that is, has, you know, there's great consequences surrounding this ring, consequences for the world itself, for Middle Earth, for the Shire. Though, like I said, the evils have not touched the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
But also we hear about the Nazgul, the nine riders, they're hunting for Baggins Shire in the Shire, and that's really what kind of sets the stakes for our hero at this point. We have is Frodo, and he's like, okay, Gandalf's like, it's time to go, and he has to, but Frodo still has to make that decision. And then you have Sam, who's brought into the story. He's one of his closest friends, his closest companion. Sam's brought in, and he's like, "Yeah, Frodo, I'll follow you wherever you go, Master. I'm there." And so they, of course, decide to take on this task and to go on this adventure, not knowing how long it may be, expecting it to, you know, just hopefully be a short adventure, but there's stakes involved. They're being hunted.
Yeah,
and that course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sets the story up well for the audience. Like, we know, we see the stakes involved here. We see what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, you have this movie's interesting because there is one thing I've always noticed about these movies is I think the structuring is very interesting. And because you have a lot of these goals set up and they meet a lot of these goals, but then there's another goal that they have to get to, but it's all in one movie. And I feel like the first one has this the most of, like, because, I mean, they get to Rivendell, and that's like a really long journey to get there. And then they find out there's more. And you have, you know, the orcs, the Uruk-hai being created. And then so you have these other enemies coming at you. And but it also all comes together well as setting up all that's going to be coming in the next few movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, setting the stage for this story that's grander than just a hobbit trying to get a ring to a certain place, to get a ring to the elves.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving pieces going on. There's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of different characters, and this grand orchestrated, this grand story.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's interesting. Cause the journey to get to Rivendell was very hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get there and you have this this moment of relief, but then you realize that's barely even the beginning for them. And
the hobbits think that it's the end.
Yeah.
Like, and they make this pretty clear in the movies that it's like, Sam talking to Frodo and saying, you know, we're gonna go home now.
Yeah,
like we've done set it. Out we've made
to,
it.
We've done what we set out to do.
Yeah,
just get the ring here,
which is actually one of my favorite moments in the film, because then after that you have the Council of Elrond, where all the men, dwarves, and elves come together to converse and discuss what are we going to do with this ring.
Yeah.
This small little object that in the film they have it sitting in the middle around as they circle around it, and it's just this tiny ring is why all these people from all across Middle Earth have come together to make a plan to decide what are we going to do. And in the book, it's long. It's a long drawn out story, because they have, you know, Gandalf retelling the story. I think, if I remember correctly, Frodo tells this, you know, their journey and what led them there, and then you have all them discussing the different ideas and plans that everyone has and what we should do, and Gandalf's telling them about the ring, the story of the ring, and how it got into the hands of Frodo, got in the hands of Bilbo. I think they talk about Smeagol and Gollum, and all these things. And then you have Frodo in the movie sitting there, hearing them, you know, the discussion escalates to an argument, and they're fighting and yelling and talking about what they should do with the ring. You have Gimli, and, you know, says, well, you know, I can't remember exactly what he says, but
yeah, it's like, let's just destroy it.
Let's destroy it.
And then he swings his axe at it, and it blows up his axe. Who's the elf guy there?
Legolas?
No.
Elrond?
Yeah, Elrond. He explains that, no, this has to be destroyed in Mount Doom.
The fires of Mount Doom.
And was it him they explained it? I think it was.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But, yeah, and you see this growing tension, and you see this power around the ring that's almost like it's enticing them to argue about it, and it's creating this division within them, and to kind of, because the ring, you know, essentially has a mind of its own, and it's trying to disrupt them from destroying it, and it wants to not die, and
it wants to go back to its master.
Yeah.
And the one who created it.
Yeah. And creator. So it knows, like, oh, I could, you know, if I make them argue about it, then they'll never be able to be unified and go on a journey. But then it really focuses on Frodo, and he's seeing this all happen and seeing them all argue, and it's drawing into him, and it's almost like scaring him. He looks very terrified. And so you're kind of uncertain of what he's thinking. And then he goes out and says that I'll take it. I'll take the ring to Mordor. You know, this little hobbit against all these, you know, great beings of, you know, you got these men and elves and dwarves and wizards. And this little hobbit says, I'll do it.
Yeah. Most unlikely of creatures.
Yeah.
The most unlikely of people stands up while everyone's bickering and arguing. Frodo knows what must be done.
Mm-hmm.
Frodo knows this is the task laid out for me. And he kind of knows that before, and he's like questioning that in himself. And of course we have a lot of story before this, you know, where we have, you know, they get caught by the Nazgul. Frodo gets stabbed, almost dies. But of course we have Strider, who's a character we haven't brought up yet, which we will talk more about him in a minute. But Strider, he's an aide to the hobbits, helping them on this journey. He accompanies them and helps lead them to Rivendell. But of course they get attacked by the Nazgul and by the Black Riders, and Frodo gets stabbed, and so Aragorn has to take him as far as he can. Eventually he finds an elf named Arwen, and who's his forbidden love, I guess, in the story. She's an elf, he's a man, And of course, they have elements of a legendary story in Middle Earth called Beren and Lúthien, where it's a man and an elf who fall in love, but they can't be together because she's immortal and he's mortal, and so forth. And of course, you have that story introduced, that love story introduced here. And, you know, they, of course, in the movies, make it more, almost Hollywoodized, or, you know, they turn into this romance a little bit more than what it is in the books, but it's there in the books. It 100% is, but it's, you know, it's more of a story element in the movies, which I'm fine with, for the most part. But we meet her, and then she takes Frodo to Rivendell to be saved, basically, so that he can be healed from this the blade, the cursed poison blade that struck him. And of course, you have that. So Frodo's gone through it. He's gone through the ringer up to this point, and
that wasn't even the first time he was stabbed. He got stabbed by the troll.
Well, yeah, that was Well,
with
yeah,
the Mithril.
Later on after they leave Rivendell. Yeah, he's.
Oh, that was after.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's in Khazad Dûn. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, he gets stabbed a lot. He goes through a lot in these films. Loses a finger. Gets, you know, stabbed by by the giant spider. By Shelob. But anyways, he goes through a lot, and up to this point, you know, he was on the verge of death, and yeah, he's sitting there as they're arguing.
Yeah.
He's like, "I will take the ring. I will do what no one else is suggesting." Actually, because you also have Boromir, another a fascinating character. Because there's so many good things about Boromir. He has a love for people, love for land, love for blood and kin. He loves his people. He loves Gondor, and he wants Gondor to be saved because Gondor has been without a king for years. Gondor is falling apart under the reign of his father, and he's in fear that, you know, as Mordor encroaches, because, you know, in Middle Earth, Gondor and Mordor are really close in proximity to each other. Mordor is encroaching. They're becoming more and more of a threat to Gondor. Gondor's falling apart. It's an empire that's crumbling, and he's there in hopes that he can bring the ring back to Gondor so that they can use the power of the ring to defeat Mordor. And of course, so he has that desire for power that is good. He wants to use it for good, but then of course we learn that that's not what the ring's for. It can really only be wielded by Sauron for that purpose. Otherwise it just corrupts man. It corrupts others who tried to wield it and use it. So Boromir, he's arguing, saying, "No, we need to use this power. It's a gift that's been given to us. Let's use it to defeat the enemy." And, you know, so I think Boromir can get a bad rap because of where that leads him, because that lust for power does consume him and you know, towards the end of the film. But it's a noble, ignorant desire that he has for the ring, and to use it for the right purposes.
Yeah.
And so all these people arguing have different ideas and plans, and then Frodo's like, "I'm going to take it." And so, you know, that moment where everyone goes silent, and Gandalf turns, knowing what he just heard, and knowing the cost that's ahead, the price that needs to be paid for Frodo, but knowing that Frodo's right. It's hard for Gandalf to admit it, but he knows that Frodo's right. He needs to take it in that moment. And so he turns and looks, and "I will take the ring to Mordor." And then sets up the kind of the rest of the story. This is, you know, if you're watching the extended edition, this is where the first movie ends, the first disc is over, and where they all decide we're going to go on this journey.
Yeah.
And you have a whole set of characters. You have, you know, of course, Samwise, who is, you know, going to go wherever Frodo goes. Then you have Merry and Pippin, the two hobbits that, of course, we haven't even brought them up. They've joined them in their they join them in the journey to Rivendell, and then now they're gonna go on this journey. I love that moment where it's like, okay, where it's like, well, we're gonna go too, and then I think it's Pippin is like, so where are we going? What's the plan here? but they're loyal friends. They're gonna, you know.
Yeah,
Frodo's going, I'm going too.
Yeah,
and then you have, of course, the moment where everyone, where you have group, you know, each person volunteers to go. You have my axe, Gimli. You have my sword, Aragorn, and my bow. Does Legolas say you have my bow? I think he does.
Yeah, I think so.
You have my bow, and
yeah,
And then
that's the only time he talks to Frodo.
Yeah,
the entire series.
Like, right, that's it.
Yeah,
right. And yeah, does he interact?
That's the only time.
I'm thinking about in the books. Like, does he interact? I don't think. That's pretty much it. But you know, they know the price. They know more than Frodo.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, because Frodo's like been through it up to this point. He knows Bilbo's past and everything, so I guess Frodo does know, but like I think they know even more, like what's ahead. But we're going to fight for him, we're going to follow him, we're going to protect him, we're going on this journey, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
Here's a good moment to bring up gender equality. Tobiah, is there a certain demographic that's missing in this group, in this fellowship? You have Gandalf, of course, as well, that's going. You have Boromir, you have Legolas, you have Gimli, you have Merry Pippin, Sam, Frodo, Legolas, Aragorn. Who's
yeah,
missing?
A bunch of white men only.
Right. Where's the girl boss? Where's the women? Why isn't Arwen coming along?
Where's the black hobbit?
Where's the Asian one? Come on, what's going on here? I don't think this would meet the DEI quota for 2025-6.
Nope.
I don't. Could they make this movie today? If they were remake Lord of the Rings.
It would not look like that. That's not what the fellowship would look like. Yeah.
We should make a spoof of this.
Yeah.
This is definitely not the fellowship would look like in 2026.
Yeah.
But did anyone make a fuss about it back then?
I don't think so.
I don't know. I mean, how much money do these movies gross? Billions of dollars altogether. Quite a bit.
Yep.
Some of the highest grossing trilogies of all time. No one gave a care in the world about how many women were involved in the fellowship. You know, we'll talk about the girl boss moments in future episodes. I'm talking about you, Eowyn. I have so many thoughts about her, good and bad. Mm-hmm. Arwen, you know, she kind of has her hero moment in this one as well. It's a little more than what we get in the books, but she's there in the book. She does save Frodo. She does help Frodo. And I think I think her character is great in the books, of course.
Well, she essentially was nurturing him too, because he was dying. And so, she was medically saving him.
Yeah. 100%.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, just want to get that out of the way. So our masculine male heroes are going on a journey to save the world,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
To save the women and children.
Yep.
You know, you don't have any female hobbits coming with them either, right? Mm-mm. It's four male hobbits, because they are going to fight for their homeland, for their people, for their families,
mm-hmm.
for their people, because they love their people, and they're going to do what needs to be done to make the sacrifices that need to be made, knowing that they may never come home. Frodo's well aware he definitely is probably not going to come home, mm-hmm. but he's going anyway, because he knows what must be done. He knows the task ahead, he knows the threat, and he's going to fight for it,
mm-hmm.
along with all these other men that are coming along with them in this journey.
Yeah.
So our fellowship takes off. Up to this point, Tobiah, any other thoughts, anything that you want to unpack, think through?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is like kind of like how I was talking about the pacing. Like at this point, it almost feels like you've watched one whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's almost entirely a three acts that have happened, and And when you watch these three movies, it does when you split these in half, it does feel like six movies. Mm-hmm. Especially like when you look at like movies that are coming out now with like part one and part two. I mean, it's a prequel,
a midquel, two-quel, three-quel, like all kinds of things.
If this came out, like they probably would have released it exactly like that and done like six movies.
Well, look at The Hobbit, man.
Yeah, well, yeah,
the shortest of all the books.
Yeah,
it's three movies.
But I mean, when you split them up, I mean, yeah. you got two-hour movies, 100%. And yeah, so I think it would work interesting.
But at the same time, it's like it's also the first act. Yeah. Of this whole story,
right?
You know, and then making the decision to set off and go. But yeah. So there is a three-act structure in this in the first movie, and of course in the first half, you know,
right.
And Tolkien wrote it that he pretty much wrote, I mean, he wrote it in six books.
Yeah.
So you're saying like, you know, six movies. Yeah, that's how Tolkien wrote it. You know, book one, book two, three, four, five, six, all the way to the end, and he paced it completely differently.
And I think Peter Jackson kind of had that in mind,
totally,
for the entire time.
I think so. So, as the Fellowship is set off, and there is a lot ahead,
mm-hmm.
a lot for us as well, because we're going to stop it here, because we, like I said before, we didn't know how long this was going to be, but we haven't really gotten into the weeds, I don't think, and there's a lot more here, a lot more we want to discuss.
We've gone through most of the story. Mm-hmm. We'll probably finish up the second and third act next time, and then that'll just be like a very short portion of the beginning of our review when mm-hmm. we come back, and then we'll do our deep dive into a lot of the aspects mm-hmm. of the movie.
Yep.
We don't want this to just be a retelling of the movies that you guys have seen,
right?
And yeah, so look forward to that, and that'll be where all the good stuff is.
Yeah, this is part one of, I think, our part two, our two parts series of
and
Fellowship.
We'll probably end up doing six parts to this entire
series. I think that's where we're going to go. You know,
I think it'll be the best.
Figuring out as we go.
Yeah. We'll.
There's just so much here. So much meat we want to chew on this bone.
Yeah.
There's just a lot to discuss.
Yeah.
And I think, I think this is a good way to set up the story going forward. These heroes are going on a journey that has cosmic proportions, that have the whole world is at stake,
mm-hmm.
and the unlikeliest of people has been given this burden that he's going to take to go on this journey to save Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And he has companions that are going on. The Fellowship has been joined, and then we'll find out later the Fellowship breaks and how that story progresses and so forth.
Yep.
So great first episode.
Yeah.
For Fearless Wandering Podcast movie reviews.
Yep.
And yeah, we're excited to continue on, and I hope you guys enjoyed this. Please, Patreon shout out if you guys want to support us. We have a lot of awesome content that's going to be mm-hmm. on Patreon, that is on Patreon, a lot of things we're doing over there. You can just follow us at patreon.com/fearlesswondering.
Yep. And we have three movies on there, a TV show. We release our podcast on there. So the lives that we do get put on there, and our movie reviews. And we also have a Patreon only show that we do for our patrons there. And all the extra stuff for What Is Christian Nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
We got the full interviews from that movie. Each one of them are on there, and we're releasing them over time.
Mm-hmm.
And just some other special features, bonus features that we're including on there. So lots of content there that is definitely worth the money. It's not very expensive, so we have that available for you guys. And yeah,
appreciate your support.
Absolutely.
And please leave a like and comment on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Please give us a 5-star review on podcasts.
Yep.
And we definitely appreciate the support and help. We put a lot of work in this, but we do it because we love it, and we want to just continue to make more content, and the more you guys support us, the more we can make. And hopefully this is of a value to you. And stay tuned for many more episodes of diving deep into
Lord
the world
of, the Rings,
of
yep.
Lord of the Rings and Middle Earth. And
yep.
Thank you, guys.
Awesome. Thank you.
We're out.
Bye.
If there's one topic in the American church that needs clarity, it's Christian nationalism.
In 40 years, approximately 40 years, 3% of the American population ultimately was able to be so successful that they were able to replace the American flag with the rainbow.
Instead of the church discipling the culture has been discipling the church.
I think for most of American history, Americans understood their nation to be a Christian nation. That instinct of wanting a people, a Christian people, is good and right. It's worth pursuing.
Almost all of the original colonies, you had to have a public profession of Protestant faith to become any kind of political leader. A great way to love the culture is to make sure that society is ruled by Christian rulers and under a Christian government.
And so if you were a Christian ruler, a king or an emperor, a president or whatever system you're in, and you were a Christian and you have power, you should be, you know, nurturing your people in the same Padilla of the Lord.
We will blaspheme the gods of leftism, globalism, yeah. Pluralism. Yes, we will blaspheme those gods and we will cut them down.
We are Christians. We are not Marxists and communists, and we're Christian nationalists. And that means that as we seek the earthly and heavenly good of our nation in our social laws and customs and all of the rest, we do so in faith.
The desire of Christ is to make the nations Christian.
Has England lost its way? Sure. Is it redeemable? Absolutely. But like everywhere else and everyone else, the only way to redemption is through Jesus Christ.
Are you aiming to make your household a little, small-scale, miniature model of civilization and harmonious living, where you're creating a beautiful and rich Christian culture in your home, in the earthly and in the heavenly, in the earthly things and in the spiritual things, in the body and in the soul?
Do you believe the United States of America is still a Christian nation?
Absolutely. This is the last stand for Christendom. It really is. People keep talking about the West, but this is not the West. This is Christendom.